Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this national telebriefing, Chernobyl Plus 31, From Nuclear Disaster to Renewable Energy Revolution. I am Tim Judson, the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and I'll be your host tonight. For those of you not familiar with NIRS, we are the primary national information and resource center for the anti-nuclear and safe energy movement in the United States. For 39 years, we have worked to end the use of nuclear power in the U.S. and for technically sound, environmentally just, and publicly acceptable solutions for radioactive waste. We provide support to grassroots activists and local campaigns, and we serve as a watchdog in Washington, D.C., leading campaigns on national policy issues such as nuclear waste storage and taxpayer subsidies for nuclear power plants. But to be successful, we need your support both in taking action on the issues and, just as importantly, in whatever financial support you can provide to our work. So if you feel this work is important, please consider making a contribution, which you can do on our website. We are pleased that so many of you could be here tonight. In 3 days, on April 29th, there will be a Global Day of Actions for Climate Justice, the People's Climate March, with a major march in Washington, D.C. and in other cities throughout the U.S. NIRS is participating in the People's Climate Movement and supporting nuclear-free, carbon-free mobilizations for April 29th. In some ways, the timing of this march could not be more appropriate for illustrating why the world needs to pursue clean, nuclear-free, carbon-free solutions to the climate crisis. For today is the 31st anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, one of the worst environmental catastrophes in human history, and one that forever changed the global energy landscape. We are proud to have our two presenters here tonight who will explain the immense gravity and impact of the Chernobyl meltdown and its ongoing relevance to solving the global environmental crises presented by climate change. Chernobyl was not the first nuclear disaster in world history, and as the triple meltdowns at Fukushima proved, it was not the last. But its impact was truly global in every sense of the word. As we say in the environmental movement, radiation knows no borders, but Chernobyl literally crossed all of them. The catastrophic explosion that occurred on April 26, 1986 in the Chernobyl No. 4 reactor in Ukraine, and the meltdown and raging fire that continued for several weeks, impacted the people of Ukraine most immediately, but the cloud of radiation reached high into the atmosphere and spread throughout most of the Northern Hemisphere. Countries throughout Europe were contaminated, and the global impact of the disaster forced millions of people to realize the need to choose safer, cleaner sources of energy. And people took action, not just to oppose nuclear power, but in ways that laid the groundwork for the modern renewable energy industries we are now counting on for the transition away from fossil fuels. Our presenters tonight will offer their experience and expertise to fill out this picture. The impact of the Chernobyl disaster and its lingering harm to people in Ukraine and other affected countries, and the crucial role it played in shaping energy policy and laying the groundwork for clean energy solutions. Our first presenter tonight is Nadia K. McConnell, president and one of the founders of the U.S.-Ukraine Foundation. In 1990, she helped establish the foundation's presence in Ukraine even before Ukrainian independence. In earlier years, she was president of NKM Associates and held several positions in the U.S. government, including director of congressional relations for the Federal Emergency Management Agency and deputy assistant administrator for legislative affairs at NASA. And our second presenter is Max Grunig, president of the Ecologic Institute U.S. Max has been with the Ecologic Institute since 2007, where his work focuses on sustainable development in the energy and transport sector, as well as urban sustainability and resilient cities. Welcome, Nadia and Max. Thank you both so much for taking the time to be with us here tonight. In a moment, we'll get started, but first I have a few instructions on how we'll handle questions and answers. Because of the large number of participants tonight, everyone has been muted except for the presenters. And at the end of each presentation, we'll have actually at the end of the presentations tonight, we'll have a period of Q&A. And so at that time, and I'll repeat these instructions later, to ask a question, you just dial *6 on your phone, and then when prompted, press 1 to be added to the queue. When it's your turn, you'll be notified that you're unmuted and you can ask your question. We are sure that there'll be plenty of questions, and we want to make sure we cover as much information as possible. So to that end, we ask that everyone make their questions as concise as possible and refrain from making long statements. So with all of that taken care of, let's hear from our presenters. Nadia, please share with us your thoughts on the Chernobyl disaster and its impact on the people of Ukraine.
Well, thank you, Tim. You know, when I first got the invitation to participate, I think I responded that I didn't necessarily think that I was a good fit for your program because I focus more on sort of what I guess would call the political dimension of Chernobyl. And what I appreciate that there are organizations like you that are still remembering Chernobyl because the world, for the most part, I think, has forgotten, even if they were really, if ever they ever really understood what was happening with Chernobyl. But Tim, you said you really thought I should, that your listeners or participants would like to hear, you know, my perspective. Why I say I didn't necessarily felt that I was perhaps might fit into your program because I focused on the reaction to the accident. And actually in 2011, I was asked to make a presentation for the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl at the UN. And that was right after the Fukushima disaster. And it provided a real contrast between how a government that is open would deal with such a catastrophe and what happened in the Soviet Union with Chernobyl. And I suspect that if you asked, if you had a survey of people, 90 plus, you know, some huge percent, would remember Chernobyl as a nuclear accident, but not necessarily know or remember that the most significant consequences caused by Chernobyl was the cover-up, which went on for years. Just as a reminder, the accident happened, as you said, on April the 26th. And there was silence for 2 days, and I think it was actually the April 28th when scientists in Sweden began to, were measuring the high level of radiation and figured out that it was coming from the Soviet Union and someplace in Ukraine. And unfortunately, hello?
Yes, we can still hear you.
Oh. And unfortunately, which has been typical of what I call the Kremlin's propaganda playbook, the first reaction is to deny that anything took place. And that was what happened then. And on May 1st, where the traditional May Day parade normally took place, the head of the Communist Party of Ukraine, Shevitsky, contacted Mr. Gorbachev and asked about canceling the May Day parade. And according to Shevitsky's granddaughter, Mr. Gorbachev said no because that would create panic and insisted that the parade continue. The radio programs the day before May talked about the beautiful flowers that were growing. And so on May 1st, the children of Ukraine and of all ethnic backgrounds and all faiths were marching down the street of the main street, Khrushchevka in Ukraine, with flowers and, you know, gay. Meanwhile, of course, from the skies, radiation was pouring over them. And what was subsequently learned was that the members of the Communist Party had evacuated not only their families, their pets, and their prize horses. And even after several weeks when it was finally acknowledged that the situation of what had happened and that it was a serious accident, no assistance was allowed to come into Ukraine. Yet we knew that from Chicago, where there's a large Polish community, there were weekly flights taking powdered milk and other basic medicines into Poland. And we, in fact, from the community here, made an appeal to Armin Hammer because he was very close, had close relationship with Gorbachev and other leaders about getting some assistance in. And what happened was that Dr. Robert Gale from California was sent to Moscow to do an assessment of the situation. Now, that's nearly 500 miles away, and so that would be like after 9/11, somebody would send somebody to Cleveland to see how things were going in New York. And that, and so of course Dr. Gale came back and said they're managing, everything is being taken care of. We also know that subsequently, we will never know the true impact of Chernobyl, particularly on the health of people, because even scientists, we learned later, who were asked to do research and measure radiation in different parts of the country, were never able to come together to present a whole full picture. It was they were kept sequestered, and so nobody really understood what was happening. Also, any deaths resulting from Chernobyl were the cause of deaths on certificates was falsified. And so it was years before any assistance was allowed into Ukraine. And I contrasted that with what happened with Fukushima. The world, you know, people are generous. Immediately, of course, there was a worldwide response. You know, we sent ships with supplies. In other words, people reacted and wanted to help and did. And unfortunately, in Ukraine, the people of Ukraine never had that response or were not given any kind of assistance. So for me, the biggest significance or disaster of the accident was not the accident itself, but what happened afterward. And unfortunately, I'm sorry that Alex Kuzma was not able to join us, and I understand he's worked with your organization before. He was the executive director of the Children of Chernobyl Foundation and has a lot more information and statistics about some of the impact, the health impact on, you know, particularly children and the general population. So as I said, my perspective about Chernobyl is perhaps slightly different than maybe a lot of your participants are aware of, or, you know, hopefully they are interested, though. I think I might stop here.
Well, Nadia, this is, I actually still agree with what I said before, that this perspective is really important because, you know, a lot of the discussion of Chernobyl that occurs these days is, you know, sort of with, you know, our benefit of hindsight and all of the information that's come out since then. But, you know, I mean, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about sort of what the experience was for people in Ukraine, you know, in the days and weeks after the accident started, and when people really became aware of what had occurred.
Well, it was sort of dribbling in, and the first information actually was coming from, you know, there were some French tourists there. There were people who operated ham radios, you know, who were getting, you know, the information was seeping out. I think Voice of America and Radio Free Liberty, you know, started broadcasting and alerting people. So, unfortunately, actually, that did create a panic because they weren't getting information from their government. It was just, you know, coming from indirect sources, and so of course you can imagine not having full information, how that impacted. I think the biggest impact that I saw was that I made my first trip to Ukraine in 1990, and I was there about, I think, four times that year. The issue of Chernobyl was paramount. It was the number one topic that people talked about. From the taxi cab driver to politicians. There was, for me, I sometimes called Chernobyl Moscow's boomerang because the sense of betrayal that people had because of Chernobyl. And see, the thing is, too, one of the most significant civil actions that arose out of Chernobyl was called Mama 86, the Mothers of Chernobyl, who, of course, were so upset because of the illnesses, the horrific things that they saw in their children. And so there was this real sense of really an uprising about the fact that they had been so betrayed by their government. So I think that, the breakup of the Soviet Union, Ukraine was the only republic of the former Soviet Union that predicated their independence, declaration of independence, on a referendum vote. So even though the parliament declared independence in August, there was a nationwide referendum vote held on December 1st in 1991. The vote for independence was over 90%. And that included in now occupied Crimea and eastern Ukraine. This, I think, to a large measure, was because of Chernobyl. Eventually the fear of what had happened, and again, not knowing and seeing children die and being sick, really stirred up, I would say, the sort of the civil resistance and the fight for independence.
That seems one of the one of the elements of this that parallels a lot of the ways in which climate change is talked about now in terms of the political instability that could result from from the types of disruption that that we see happening with with water shortages and large storms and those sort of things.
Yeah, I think the other thing, of course, there are other nuclear power plants in Ukraine. And so, of course, that created an awareness, because I remember after independence and when there was now, we were more engaged in Ukraine and the whole issue of Ukraine giving up its nuclear weapons. But one of the issues was to get assistance in shoring up some of the other nuclear power plants, because one of the issues with the Soviet power plants is that they were built for dual capacity. I mean, unlike in this country, the nuclear power plants were built to provide energy. But in the Soviet Union, they were built so they could provide both energy and then also be capable of nuclear weapon, production. So it was this dual use, I think, that also sort of contributed maybe to the complexity of the of the power plants and and therefore maybe the accidents. But there like I say, there were several others that had could potentially have been a problem. And I mentioned earlier that we had a delegation from Lithuania, which included two former prime ministers and current members of their parliament, and they took part in our commemoration of Chernobyl. And they expressed also concern because there is a power plant in Belarus, I guess right near the border of Lithuania, which of course could also be a candidate for some for some accident. But so these concerns I think do continue, and I think it's just raised awareness. I think the whole issue also raised awareness not only of let's say nuclear power plants, but I think the environment, the overall issue of environment and concerns about the environment, it helped raise the consciousness of people about all of these issues, which they might not have had before.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Nadia. I think we'll move now to Max Grunig to talk about the ways in which this impacted thinking about energy and in Europe as well. Max, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tim. And I want to just continue on the thought processes on the discussion that just went on. And I think what Nadia said, although I was not in the USSR at the time at all, and I don't have the inside perspective either, but I do believe that the environmental movement had a huge factor in the end of the Eastern Bloc, and also especially we can see that closely in my home country in Germany, where Eastern Germany also had a strong environmental movement that definitely accelerated, and if it was not the decisive factor, it was definitely one of the decisive factors. And I think that's something that some rather authoritarian governments have maybe remembered from then. I think that might be also one of the reasons why we see now in China more sensitivity towards environmental issues, because environmental issues can become into political issues rather quickly if they're not dealt with. But I want to come back to today's topic and not just go off path that way. So going back to 1986, so I'm already German. I think everybody understood this by now because of the accent. So I'm German. I was born and raised in West Berlin. So West Berlin, it was, of course, a little island in East Berlin. So it was relatively eastern for any of the Western, it wasn't a country, but it was a territory, and in relatively close, almost in the Eastern Bloc at the time. And of course, we did not have very preferential information, and Nadia mentioned that, so there was no immediate information, but there was this slowly seeping in of information. And just to give you a perspective, so at the time in 1986, I was not an academic or anything. I was 7 years old. So all the accounts that come from this perspective of a child and are more public more what I perceived in my environment. So information came in slowly. Once it became clear that there was really something terrible going on in the East, and of course I had no idea where Chernobyl was, and had just an idea that it was in the East, and it was far, but maybe not very far away, we were banned from going outside. We were banned from going onto the playgrounds. We could not go play outside at all for quite a while. I don't remember exactly whether it was for a year or whether it was for less. It was definitely a prolonged time. I also remember, and of course that's a luxury perspective, that definitely people in Ukraine and also in Poland and even in East Germany did not have the luxury to do that. We switched our milk and butter supply to Danish only, because that escaped a little bit the fallout. So the fallout from the radiation came down quite a bit, I think, over Czech Republic and partly also Eastern Germany. So it came close to actually where we lived. And also, of course, a lot of the food imports into Berlin originally came from East Germany. So we cut this out. Avoided that actually from then on for many, many years. And also, of course, that meant no more foraged mushrooms, which is a delicacy, or eating venison or boar, because all the animals in the woods would, of course, also over many years, they would accumulate the radioactive, the radionuclides in the food chain, and they would just accumulate them in their organs, and that would be very unhealthy. I think you can still measure increased radiation levels in mammals, in deer and in boar and in other animals that live in the forest in Germany. And so this is still something that's a mixed pleasure to indulge in. And that was definitely a very, very strong impact on our everyday life. It was a very much felt throughout. There was not really much we could do at the time, but of course it changed everything overnight. We also started then to think more about actually what the risks are and what we actually surrounded of. And of course, Germany, just before the 86 Chernobyl accident, also had already a nuclear risk discussion in the early 80s, when it was about the stationing of short or mid-range nuclear ballistic missiles in Germany. And and the arms race in the early 80s. So there was already some some inflammation in the general population. And I think both of these events really then led to this very strong green and peace movement within Germany and within West Germany, and that led to the formation of a relatively strong Green Party, which also then later on would go and be in parliament, and then in 98 actually be in government function. But it also led to a realization that we also have a danger at home. Germany at the time, I believe, had something like 22 nuclear reactors in West Germany, and there was only one in East Germany, and that was not really running and was decommissioned in 1990, put out of service in 1990, and then decommissioned. Actually, one of the early examples where we can also see what the costs are for full decommissioning. And then, of course, was the question, what will happen with all the nuclear reactors in West Germany? And there was kind of a back and forth about this. But in the 90s, we started with experimenting with a so-called feed-in tariff or payments for generating renewable electricity. And in the beginning, the impact was very, very small. And in 1990, still, the percentage of renewable energy was only 3% in the total electricity, whereas the nuclear share was considerably higher. It was, I believe, something like close to 30%, a little under 30%. It never was above that. And over the years, we can see a very strong political process where the renewables grow over time, and step by step, we see eventually a decrease of the renewable of the nuclear energy, and also political decisions taken on the pathway. First, I mentioned this already, the Green Party in Germany, which is strictly anti-nuclear, was in the beginning the only anti-nuclear party, came to power in 98 with Gerd Schröder, and then one of their programs was to start the retirement or plan for retiring nuclear energy. That was then later on by the subsequent government coalition, liberals and conservatives, was then reversed. And so there was a turning back the clock, basically. But then happened Fukushima, and that was the end to nuclear power in political terms in Germany. Of course, in reality, we still have nuclear power, but that really then led to the final decision of the conservative chancellor, Angela Merkel, who has a PhD in physics, so knows, it comes from the natural science side, and then decided directly after Fukushima that this was now no longer be the energy source or one of the energy sources in Germany, that nuclear power would leave the energy spectrum, and in order to make this an organized process and something also where the power providers or the operators, the owners of the nuclear plants could live with, they set a scheduled date for 2022. And that also implies that we still have quite a few nuclear power plants online. Most of them are very old. Nowadays, the percentage is around 13%. At least that's what it was last year, the total power contribution, whereas renewables are now 35%. So it's kind of a change, almost a reversal in the roles. And every year, there's some nuclear reactors retiring. The operators have the freedom to retire the least profitable ones and the oldest ones first. and can keep the more modern ones and the less risky ones longer online, so that the phase out is as cost effective as possible. And but overall, a lot of the nuclear installations in Germany are, of course, old and aging. We, of course, have some of the highest standards, or at least we believe that and want to believe that in technology. So there has not been a major nuclear accident in Germany, but, of course, there have been many almost and near accidents and many smaller accidents. And we are also, of course, surrounded by other countries with very aging nuclear inventory. And that's a very troublesome fact. And that refers both to the East, where there's old nuclear power plants that are poorly maintained and don't comply with the state of the art and in terms of safety. And also new constructions, of course, happening in some member states, especially if we look to Finland, which is not that far away, and also looking to the UK building a new power plant. And then we see very old and very risky reactors also in France, and France also has the tendency to have reactors right on the border or in line of sight of the border. And one of the largest one is in Cattenom. You can see it from the German border, but it's not the most accident-prone. It's a Fessenheim plant. And then there is in Belgium a plant very close to the German city of Aachen, which troubles the local population there to the degree that the government issued iodine tablets to the local population in a preventive move just in case something would go wrong, so the population has access without waiting for government to step in. So these are, of course, overall, just to close this so we can come to the Q&A, I would say both a very positive story in a way, in the sense how Germany really overcoming through very drastic accidents and events moved in this broad government consensus across all party aisles to decide on a nuclear phase-out, to also accept this as a science-based decision, as evidence-based decision, and also then accept other technologies instead and not just shut it down without looking for alternatives. I think that's a very positive story. It's, of course, a very troubling story if we look to other European member states where there are many power plants that are very risky. And then if you look outside of Europe, it gets even more troublesome. And I think just from, I'm not a statistician, but I think we're very, very happy that lucky that so far we did not have more nuclear accidents. And if we look at the operations, even the Chernobyl one, this was a disaster, if I understand it correctly, that was man-made due to mishandling of the infrastructure. And I think this is something that can always happen anywhere, and that just shows you the risk of such a technology. And I think if we can say one thing is that, yes, you can do cost-benefit assessments and you can do risk assessments, but this risk is kind of the black swan-style risk where you just cannot factor this in and you just don't want to take this into account as a risk in your cost estimates. So that's from me, and of course I hope we'll have an interesting conversation coming up now.
Yeah, if I might just add something, I think I alluded to it, but you reminded me that actually when you talk about the Green Party, that is also what happened in Ukraine. the Green Party in the 90s was probably one of the largest and strongest. And a lot of, as I said, it was because of Chernobyl. And frankly, all of the free and democratic Ukraine candidates in the parliament, actually, their main platform was against what happened in Chernobyl. And then just general environmental concerns, you know, the deforestation, across the board, it really, I think the environment movement in Ukraine, maybe unfortunately, was very strong in the 90s and a little bit beyond, but I don't think we see that as much today. But I think it was the driving force. But unfortunately, I don't think there's a stable, as strong today as it was then.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you, Max, and thank you, Nadia. I think we will move into the Q&A part of the agenda. And just as a reminder to anybody who'd like to ask a question, just dial *6, and then you'll hear a prompt on your line to press 1, and at that point you'll be added to the queue. And then when it's your turn, you'll be notified that you're unmuted and you can ask your question. So maybe as people are getting in the queue here, Nadia, I wanted to return to something that you said in your presentation about the real impact of Chernobyl was because of the cover up by the Soviet government. And I know you've also had experience in working for the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the U.S. And I wonder if you could kind of give us your thoughts on what an appropriate government process would be to responding to a type of disaster like Chernobyl.
Oh dear, you're reminding me of my days at FEMA, which actually was I was there at the time of the very strong anti-nuclear movement here, and FEMA was responsible for the emergency planning. I mean, we were working with the Nuclear Regulatory Agency. But the difference was it's just night and day because there were, for each power plant here in this country, there were emergency, plans. There were training exercises. Mobilization, how to, evacuate. I mean, there was a lot of work done in anticipation that, God forbid, something would happen. So the planning, to try to be prepared for something, which, of course, none of that existed in the Soviet Union. So that's a huge different approach.
Sure. So the Soviet Union didn't even have the type of response organization that would have been necessary to handle that type of...
No, absolutely not. It was totally... And, of course, first of all, if you don't acknowledge there's a problem, then you can't even call on all your resources, to try and manage it. And, of course, some of the decisions that were made early on in Chernobyl proved to be, in some ways, disastrous in terms of trying to contain the situation. And, of course, also we know now, even though there's now, we're building a shelter, and but that's not going to be forever. So it's still an ongoing problem, but because there were no contingency plans and because it wasn't a matter of, calling all the experts together and saying, okay, how do we manage it? It's sort of done on the fly. And so that's, under any circumstances, that's not how you want to operate.
Sure. Okay, well, I think we'll go to our first question from one of the audience. Should be unmuted to ask your question now.
Hello, my name is Robert Kolkebeck. I live in Park Forest, Illinois. And the political leadership in Illinois does not consider nuclear energy life-threatening. Writing passionate letters and making phone calls has no impact. Do you have any recommendations about changing their perspective? I believe that collective boycotts or some sort of civil disobedience or creating that economic disruption may be necessary, but I really don't have a clue on how to get political leadership to take nuclear energy threats seriously.
Well, it's if I may try, I mean, from a German perspective, it's very hard to answer this because, of course, in Germany, I could say, well, it also took Germans quite a bit of time. And actually, the phase-out, if you see the last one going offline, presumably by 2022. And so if you even just go back to the early 80s and say that's the beginning of, or the mid-80s to the beginning of the serious nuclear opposition, and that's a long time. And so you're definitely in for a long process there. But the complicated factor there is that you, of course, can't just transpose experiences from Germany to the U.S. because the risk awareness level or the risk tolerance level is very different. And I think in Germany there is a, even though it's a country that's prone or known for its engineering and technology and innovation, it also has a little bit of a, cautious side to it, and it's not as openly embracing technological innovation as it's maybe the culture in the U.S. So I would think I would add to that even more years. So definitely a long-term project you're into.
And Nadia, do you have any thoughts on that, given some of the insights you might have about the political leadership at sort of a higher level?
I don't know if I quite understand the question. What is the goal? Are you
sure? I think the question was, sort of how can ordinary citizens be communicating with their elected representatives to help them understand their level of concern about these type of dangers?
Well, but is the goal? I mean, are you wanting to pull down the power? I mean, I don't even know if that's so.
Sure. No, that's a very good question. I think what we've had experience, at NEARS was, while our organization obviously is, has a very strong stance on the issue of nuclear power, we do a lot of advocacy around issues like nuclear power plant safety and emergency planning and those sort of things. And so, in the wake of the Fukushima disaster, we had started, an effort to get the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to improve the emergency planning regulations that govern nuclear power plants, and with that was trying to get to raise awareness among members of Congress and local elected officials who might be able to have some say in those matters.
Well, I think certainly oversight by the citizenry, I think, is very important. And I think just as what you said, I mean, to continue to advocate or, about the preparedness and the training and the planning and just, that you're looking at it, that you're paying attention, I think certainly is important because, nobody's infallible. And accidents do happen, but I think if there's greater vigilance and greater preparedness, I mean, I think with Fukushima, I think the response, and I can't remember how long it took, but I think they were certainly much more prepared, to handle the situation than what we saw in Chernobyl. So I think the preparedness is key, and I again with the citizenry, being a constant, advocate or just vigilant about it, I think just makes the situation better.
Sure, I think one of the similarities. I mean, I think there was a lot more transparency as to the fact that there was an accident happening at Fukushima at the time. There was, and actually the former prime minister talks about this, there was a real problem of the government having accurate information from the utility company about what was happening. so that in fact they, you know, they actually made some mistakes in their emergency response, you know, in terms of where they were directing people to evacuate from and to.
Right.
It was based on misinformation, and you know, I think you're absolutely right that there was that there was not the same kind of you know, cover up, and there were actions being taken, you know, in the moment.
And so whatever mistakes, as I recall, I mean, I think they were adjusted or corrected within, you know, days, you know, but, you know, we're in Chernobyl. I mean, you know, Mr. Gorbachev has never to this day acknowledged that there were mistakes made. I mean, that's kind of putting it mildly. So, you know, so I think, again, that's kind of a different approach. And I think here, you know, we are much more transparent, and you have, you know, citizens have more access to, you know, what's going on. And so I think that's the best, you know, I think, solution to prevention, you know, of any kind of a accident.
Sure. Okay, well, we'll move on to our next question. This is from a caller from a 248 area code.
Yes, hello. Max had mentioned that Belgium had started distribution of KI, or potassium iodide, and likely because of the age and risk status of the reactor that he mentioned that was near the border of Germany. I was wondering if he could please share with us to what degree he is aware of that Germany and other European countries developed KI distribution programs. Are they mandated or voluntary, and are they localized to the particular plants, or are they more of a general distribution throughout the areas?
Right. So I want to say, so the tablets are being distributed on the German side of the border because of the plant on the Belgian side of the border. And I am a big fan of Belgium, don't get me wrong. Great chocolate and great beer. But people are really worried about this particular plant. And people are living very nearby. And that's one of the challenges with the border, because, of course, you have jurisdiction only on your territory, so you cannot do much other than getting the tablets on your side or move away, the other option. So how these are distributed? So I know that in Germany there is for emergency response, is the civil defense infrastructure that's co-shared with the local authorities and federal government, and also military supporting partially. So they do the readiness for actual disasters, but the pre-disaster distribution of these pills, to my knowledge, would come rather from the health department of the local government, but this could be actually coming out of the reservoirs of the disaster readiness supply. So that I'm not exactly sure about. There is generally not such a distribution of medication, so this is a kind of a unique situation even for Germany. I know that after the Fukushima incident, people bought individually from pharmacies or ordered via pharmacies and bought tablets, and some people also actually took them, even though there was no medical indication for doing this in Germany, being so far from the Fukushima incident that there was no actual need for that. But that's just to show you how this really resonated within the German public. I hope I answered this somewhat.
Sure, and just so everyone understands, the reason for discussion about potassium iodide is that it's It's a way of protecting thyroids from absorbing the radioactive iodine that's released in a nuclear disaster like Chernobyl or Fukushima. It's actually, you know, the only radioisotope that the body can be physically protected from in any meaningful way in those situations. And aside from taking the type of emergency response measures that Nadia was discussing, that were avoided in the Chernobyl disaster by the government's inaction.
Yeah, and interesting point about. In fact, this was discussed today. Of course, one of the biggest things that we saw in Ukraine was thyroid cancers. And as I understand it, that both in Hiroshima and Fukushima, that there was not as much of an impact because of the natural diet that they have, which gives them higher levels, I guess, of iron in their system. So that was sort of interesting, the impact of the diet that they had in terms of resisting or being, to radiation.
Okay, great. So moving on to our next call, this is from a caller from a 360 area code.
Hello, this is Carolyn Treadway, and I'm calling from Lacey, Washington, next to Olympia, Washington. And I wanted to respond to some of the comments about Fukushima, if that's all right.
Certainly.
Okay. I did not know about the cover-up in Chernobyl. I've learned more about that by far from this call, and it's really terrible. But I've also heard Nadia talk about how different the United States is. And I think it's a matter of degree more than difference, because in the United States we have a lot of cover-up. In Japan there was a lot of cover-up. And then Soviet Union did a mega, mega cover-up. We in the United States have the evacuation plan around nuclear reactors, but they may be completely and entirely inadequate, such as to evacuate if there was something at Indian Point. You're going to evacuate all of Manhattan. Where are you going to take them? In Fukushima, and I have been to the area, Fukushima Prefecture, and around twice since the disasters and talked with people about what they experienced. They did not know, as you said, Tim, they did not know. And so some of them were evacuated to higher radiation areas and so on. But the not knowing has not stopped, and the cover-up of information has not stopped. I listened to Arne Gunderson's seminar that you had at NIRS, and he talked about finding out that radiation made it unsafe to be living in areas that were declared clean and safe, and the cleaned is put in quotes because it's not clean. That's my comment. And the government of Japan is now asking people to move back into areas that are still irradiated, and Arne Gunderson found that with his measurements. And so there's still cover-up going on, which greatly concerns me. And there are many thyroid abnormalities between the children, among the children already. So it's just my concern is that we learn from Chernobyl and we learn from Fukushima. And one of the things we learn is that responsible parties like TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, or our nuclear industry, or the government, don't tell the whole truth. And then people are left to make decisions without information that's really adequate. For some heartrending stories on this, I would recommend people going to redkimono.org and looking under memoirs and letters. And there you have one woman talking about the anguish for her long after the disaster, a year or two after. Was still not knowing what was and wasn't safe. She finally had to leave the area because she could not know what was safe and what wasn't, and the agony of that decision and of leaving her husband and her father behind and so on.
Sure. Well, thank you for that, Carolyn.
Yeah.
And I would offer it to either of our presenters if there's anything you'd like to respond to there. If not, we can go on to our final question.
Sure, I'm fine.
Yes, likewise.
Okay, great. This is from a caller from a 240 area code.
Thanks, Tim. This is Kevin Camps with Beyond Nuclear. And I guess it's sort of related, the questions I have in my mind. So the first one, given the climate march on Saturday, is what thoughts the presenters have about the dangers of things like extreme weather and climate chaos towards nuclear power. I mean, it was mentioned the design flaw at Chernobyl, the operator error, and then, of course, at Fukushima it was an earthquake and a tsunami, but with climate chaos, the dangers, the risks of more nuclear disasters. But the second question is specifically to Nadia about Ukraine. Given the armed conflict in the country, what concerns there are about the armed conflict towards nuclear safety, given the operating reactors still?
I give Nadia first for that.
Okay.
If you want to go first.
Well, I'll take the question about, I guess, Ukraine. One of the biggest concerns that we have is the nuclearization of Crimea, that Putin has reintroduced nuclear weaponry into Crimea. So that is an issue. I'm not aware necessarily of any particular concerns regarding a nuclear power plant because of the war in eastern Ukraine. Of course, the humanitarian catastrophe there is just, unfortunately, also is not necessarily seen by most of the world. There are about 5 million people that have been affected that are in need of humanitarian assistance. 2 million people that are internally displaced, and maybe it's because they're internally displaced. We don't hear as much about that as opposed to, the Syrians who are leaving Syria. So, but as far as the nuclear question, mainly it's focused on what's happening in Crimea.
Okay, I will try to answer this very, very broad question concisely as possible. So first of all, yes, I think, of course, there are current risks, and some of these risks are amplified with increasing temperatures and sea level rise, and especially, of course, for reactors that are built on the water or at low altitudes. I mean, we see that in Miami, where the reactor is seawater cooled and depends on the seawater temperature for the effective operation. And if I'm not entirely making this up, but they already had to revise the safety threshold in order to allow it to perform during summer because of the insufficient cooling potential to the old safety standards. In France, we already have, if you're aware, France has over 75% of electricity from nuclear, so it's highly dependent on nuclear. And we had a heat wave in Europe and including France in 2013, and that led to massive power outages because, of course, the hot water in the rivers reduced the cooling potential, reduced the safety, led to running these reactors then on low productivity because of the increased or the reduced cooling potential there. So this is something that's actually not just an accident risk, but it's just, you have less reliable electricity sources definitely if you rely on outside water for cooling. And it can be river water that's getting warmer, but it can also be ocean water getting warmer, as is the case in Florida. And then the other big risk, which is totally not climate-related, is, of course, having reactors near or on seismic zones, be it in California where or elsewhere in the country. that's, of course, a risk. And then with sea level rise, there's also, of course, the risk of flooding or tsunami-like impact. Overall, though, I want to say the major risk is not the, I would say, this climate-related risk, but it's more like the failure to face the the reality that these reactors are aging quickly, and it's very expensive to keep them running. There's no plan to how to retire them in an orderly way. There's this phantom hope of new technology coming in that will be cheaper, safer, more reliable, but this is like waiting for fusion technology. And there is no acknowledgement that there is a need to replace these reactors with other technology, to phase them out, and to actually decommission them and find a solution to get to tear them down. So that's, of course, that's my opinion, but that's something I see that's not addressed, and it seems to be politically not fully opportune yet, but the underlying story is also that nuclear energy is becoming economically unviable. It's no longer able to compete with the renewables or natural gas, and it will eventually fade out. So it's there's no way to build new power stations in any meaningful way in the United States or in any other market economy.
Well, thank you for that, Max, and thank you as well, Nadia. And I really appreciate your taking some extra time as we went past the 9 o'clock hour. Wanted to just offer an opportunity for either one of you to make any final remarks or address any points that you thought that would be that you'd like to make.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't necessarily have all the numbers, but going back to Chernobyl. You know, it's still unfinished business. And, you know, there have been multiple international pledging conference to deal with Chernobyl over the years, including there was one for the 25th anniversary. Unfortunately, they've never reached the goal. And so it is still a concern about how to deal with what is there. And, of course, they're building a sarcophagus now. But, again, it's not a permanent solution. And so I guess anything that could be done to, again, get the world's attention that this is still an ongoing issue and a problem that needs attention. It's not a historical accident. It doesn't belong in the history book. It still has issues that are there today that need to be addressed not only by Ukraine but also by the international community. So anything that you can do in that regard would be most appreciated.
Yeah, Nadia, I just wanted to add to that. That's a very good point that it's not just an issue. It wasn't caused by the people in the Ukraine because it came onto them in the form of this authoritarian Soviet government, and now you have to bear the consequences in Ukraine, so you definitely need in Ukraine the support of the international community. And I think that's a very important message because you're right, it's just been very rarely mentioned in all the reporting I've seen recently about Ukraine. There's never a word about Chernobyl.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Well, again, thank you both for your presentations tonight and for taking the time to share your insights tonight. And thank you to everybody who's called in for this presentation. Really hope that you learned as much as we did from this, and that you'll return for more presentations like this in the future. So with that, I'd like to say good night, and again, thank you to everybody for being here tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, and appreciated the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you also. Thank you. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
Yes, good night.
Good night.